The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be your host and to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear, and going in pursuit of the enigmatic as we do every week via our station affiliates at the UNAX Radio Network. And of course, listen on demand via podcasting apps in pockets all throughout space and time. Great to have you guys aboard and connecting with this week's transmission. A few things we're looking at this week include how material recently discovered on an asteroid may be older than the planets themselves. Some of the most primitive ever studied, according to experts. We also have stellar DNA and what it's revealing about mysterious star quakes, mysterious ghost-like phenomena out there in space. And, in fact, as far as phenomena and the subject of space, the American Space Agency, NASA, recently announced in recent days that they intend to weigh in on the ever-timely topic of UAP. That's right, and I'm going to give you a complete update on what they have said, when this study will ensue. And then finally, also on the subject of UAP, if we presume that there is an intelligence behind this phenomena, right? Not just little plasmas floating around, not just weather balloons and misidentifications of prosaic things. Yeah, if in at least some instances we are seeing what many seem to think that UAP represent, intelligently controlled technological devices of unknown origin, then we have to ask ourselves a number of other questions. Chief among them, who are they, why are they here, and what is their intent? What is the intention behind their presence here? Of course, depending on what UAP might represent, there could be any number of possible answers to that question. And it's a question that many people have asked. Many scientists right now are looking at possibilities. What could this all represent for humankind? And although it's going to be a while before we get the results from the forthcoming NASA study, which is set to ensue later this year, something tells me these sorts of questions might also be on the minds of some of those who are going to be leading this study. I'll give you evidence of why I think that a bit later on. Lots to cover this week. And as always, I hope you guys had a fantastic weekend and that your week is now off to a good start. Getting into what's been happening in the news, I mentioned, of course, that there are materials older than the planets that scientists have recently been studying. And these, in the form of samples returned to Earth by a Japanese asteroid mission. That is right, we're talking about the asteroid Ryugu. And according to space.com, this asteroid contains some of the most primitive material that has ever been studied in a laboratory on Earth, now, of course, that it's been brought back here. As Keith Cooper reports, because it is so old, it is made of the same stuff, he says, that formed the planets. And so what does that mean? Well, according to Hisayoshi Urimoto, a professor at Hokkaido University in Japan, he says Ryugu is one of the building blocks of Earth. Plain and simple. Now, a bit of background here. The Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency's Hayabusa 2 spacecraft launched back in December 2014 and arrived at the asteroid in question in 2019, whereafter it began collecting small samples of regolith, amounting about 5.4 grams in total. Those samples then landed on Earth in a capsule that was equipped with a parachute back in December 2020. And now upon analysis, we are looking at the literal stuff from which planets have been made, according to researchers who have examined it. Now, Ryugu is a carbonaceous chondrite. Very occasionally, these kinds of space rocks actually make their way to Earth, and this is one reason that astronomers are so interested in studying them. In particular, what makes these objects interesting is the fact that they're made from a stony material that's very rich in carbon. But according to space.com, remote observations by Hayabusa 2 did find some unexplained discrepancies, which include a darker surface color on the asteroid, as well as a larger abundance of what's called silosilicate materials and a more porous composition than expected. And so laboratory analysis was required to better understand exactly what we were looking at here. Well, Ryugu is somewhat similar, they say, to the Avuna meteorite. And as I mentioned, these carbonaceous chondrites sometimes do make their way to Earth. Well, this one landed in Tanzania back in 1938. And naturally, scientists would want to make comparisons between the regolith samples collected from Ryugu and this carbonaceous chondrite, so it was actually loaned by the National History Museum in London to Yokoyama's team for their study. And they've now found a number of things, like, for instance, that Ryugu's materials, due to the presence of hydrogen and other noble gases in the regolith samples that were collected, can be dated. And what they're saying right now is that a close match in terms of the composition of what we found on that asteroid would be what we detect on the sun's visible surface, otherwise known as its photosphere, which is used as a proxy for the composition of the solar nebula. So as Keith tells us in his Space.com article, no meteoritic or asteroidal material studied in a laboratory on Earth has ever been found to be so primitive and pristine. And that certainly also applies to the Tanzanian Avuna meteorite. It might have been that pristine at one point long ago, but it certainly isn't today. So needless to say, we may yet still have a few surprises in terms of what we are yet to learn about these astonishing samples of primordial star stuff that astronomers have collected from Ryugu. But as far as other strange phenomena happening out there, have you ever heard of what's known as a starquake? That's right, Hannah Devlin over at The Guardian wrote about this recently, noting that astronomers have apparently unveiled the most detailed survey of the Milky Way, and they've found thousands of these starquakes, as well as stellar DNA, they say, which helps us to identify the most habitable corners of our home galaxy. You know, there are a lot of planets out there, and astronomers are always looking for potentially habitable ones. As Hannah now tells us over there at The Guardian, observations from the European Space Agency's Gaia probe have covered almost 2 billion stars. For anybody wondering, that's about 1% of the total number expected to exist in our galaxy. And this is allowing astronomers to reconstruct our home galaxy's structure and find out how it has evolved over billions of years. Now, Gaia, the robotic spacecraft in question, was launched back in 2013. And this isn't its first go around our cosmic neighborhood. No, in fact, previous surveys that it's carried out pinpointed the motion of stars in our home galaxy in exquisite detail, as Hannah says. But by rewinding these movements, astronomers have been able to kind of perform modeling of our galaxy, and that helps us understand how it has actually changed and taken shape over time. As The Guardian reports, the latest observations add details of chemical compositions, stellar temperatures, colors, masses, and ages based on spectroscopy, where starlight is split into different wavelengths. So why is all that important? Well, these measurements, they point out, unexpectedly revealed thousands of these so-called starquakes, in other words, cataclysmic tsunami-like events that occur on the surface of stars. According to Connie Ertz of the KU Leuven in Belgium, a member also of the Gaia collaboration that's currently underway, she says starquakes teach us a lot about stars, notably their internal workings. Gaia, she adds, is opening a gold mine for astroseismology of massive stars. Did you even know that there was such a thing as astroseismology? But you know, this is an interesting question. Is it possible that some of these so-called starquakes and other kinds of things we're learning about the behaviors of stars might help us to unravel some of the existing mysteries about weird things we see out there in space? I'm not talking about UAP just yet. Before we get into that discussion, let's look at something else that's been baffling astronomers for quite a while, and those are fast radio bursts. According to a recent CNN report, they note that mysterious fast radio bursts have long intrigued astronomers because they don't understand exactly what causes those bright, millisecond-long flashes in space. But now, a pulsing burst of radio waves has been detected in a galaxy about 3 billion light-years away. And this one, they say, is even stranger than the others previously observed. This celestial object constantly released weaker radio waves between the repeating bursts. And it's significant to note that because there's only one other fast radio burst that's currently been discovered that is known to do this. And so astronomers are now questioning if there's more than one kind of these unexplained phenomena. So what exactly causes them? You know, there are a lot of theories about what fast radio bursts might be. Some have posited they could be magnetars. It could be a trick of light, an optical effect that over great distances causes them to appear a certain way, or for the light that they emit to be received by us in ways that give this appearance. And of course, although we are indeed closing in on possible explanations, every time we find a different fast radio burst that behaves a little differently from the others, it really does kind of send us back to the proverbial drawing board asking, okay, you know, is there more to this than meets the eye? Do we have all the answers necessarily? Quite obviously, we don't have all the answers. That much should be clear already. And then there is that ever novel proposition that, you know, some of these strange phenomena that we see out there could actually have some relevance to the kind of thing we'll be discussing later when it comes to the intention of UAP. I always try to be very careful about leading with any kind of statements that seem to infer that I presume anything about what UAP might be, but I do recognize a few more things than many scientists seem to. Often in the scientific debate about UAP these days, we hear people saying a lot of things about natural phenomena, a lot of things about foreign drones. I've actually gotten a lot of pushback from colleagues of mine who are journalists and, with respect I'll say, many of them fairly new to this debate, and some of them may say things like, you know, you really seem to push the idea that there should be openness toward possibilities, that otherworldly phenomena might be at play here. Whereas, in fact, we can probably assume the majority of these things that our military pilots and others are seeing are just drones, right? And so, Micah, you aren't helping by constantly insinuating that people need to be open to otherworldly possibilities when, in fact, simpler explanations would suffice. Now, of course, I respect and appreciate those comments without taking them necessarily to heart, and I'm more than happy to say I'm very glad that in all of your many 2 or 3 years you've spent studying UFOs, or UAP as they're now called, you've managed to assess this phenomenon so comprehensively that you've drawn these conclusions, and you, of course, are pointing this all out to me, really helping educate me a lot in terms of what this all really involves, huh? Now, in my very few 10, 15, or 20 years reading into this, studying the history of the phenomena, getting scientific perspectives on things, trying to sharpen my own skeptical approaches, and never give myself to any particular possibility in the absence of a complete data set, always looking at all the data, trying not to exclude even some of the more outlandish sounding reports for fear of missing pertinent details. Yes, in the few couple of decades I've spent studying this, maybe what I have learned in sum total is we shouldn't be too quick to leap to conclusions. Everybody seems to gravitate toward a pet theory early on, and if they manage to stay with the subject long enough, usually what happens is if they're honest, they begin to see that those pet theories become challenged, and they don't end up actually knowing as much as they thought they knew. So, with respect to some of my journalist friends out there who think they've figured this all out, they're going to blow the lid off all of this. It's our own government, they're testing stuff, these things are ours, and they aren't telling our boys and girls up there in the jet aircraft what they're seeing. Yeah, wait a few more years, you might be surprised. And of course, as we move closer to our discussion forthcoming about this NASA study that has been planned, one has to ask, if there were really just a bunch of black programs, special access type programs that were cooking up all this kind of technology, and even our military didn't know all the stuff that it had, wouldn't it be a tremendous waste of time for civilian scientists, for the U.S. Space Agency, NASA, to be getting involved, for world governments to be trying to unite, for politicians, lawmakers to all be saying we need to study these things? Wouldn't it be strange that the things that we are creating are being tested in places that they are apparently endangering pilots? Wouldn't it be really strange if these things were actively jamming radar systems on board F-A-18 Super Hornets out there in controlled airspace, effectively committing acts of war against, well, if they're ours, our own American servicemen and women? I mean, when you really stop to look at all of this, we can't rule out any possibility, and I don't rule out the idea that these are just our own technologies, right? These are just UAS systems developed by the U.S. military. Nothing to see here. Move along. Yeah, I don't rule out those possibilities, but if that were the ultimate solution to all of this, that too would present a lot of problems, wouldn't it? And yet, I maintain a deeper look at the relevant information about this subject, much of which appears to be ignored by many of our best and brightest in government who are looking at this stuff right now, and not all of them, by the way. I've spoken to a few people in recent days who have, at very least, given me hope in terms of the kinds of things that they're paying attention to. I hope sincerely the folks up there at the AIMSOG will take to heart the idea that, hey, you know what, history shouldn't be forgotten, things shouldn't be left out of the equation. Let's educate ourselves on this topic. Well, What a concept. Indeed, if we can do that, we may make some headway. But with knowledge of the historical background, the underpinnings of this subject now, many, many decades in the making, again, I'm pretty sure that there is a lot more to this phenomenon than just drones, balloons, weather phenomena, and mundane things. And fundamentally, it would really seem strange to me that the Pentagon would be studying it if that's all they thought these things were. But on that note, coming back around again to the fast radio bursts and other mysterious phenomena that we're studying, you know, it's important that we be open to different ideas. And it very well may be the case, although I think it's unlikely with fast radio bursts, in my own opinion, it may be the case that some of these kinds of things are representative of what some have suggested they could be. Communication, right? This could be a form of extraterrestrial communication. Beacons, lighthouses, in a sense, from far away, that are intended to draw our attention, to get us asking questions, and ultimately, perhaps also even leading up to some kind of contact, and then maybe even the exchange of ideas, of technology, any number of other things. But this, again, is one of the reasons we'll be looking at the intention question with regard to UAP this week, because if indeed UAP represent any kind of, again, for lack of a better expression, alien technology, they don't seem to be very interested in trying to openly, actively, and consistently communicate with us. Why is that the case? Again, these questions must be asked. Before we go in that direction, one more mystery of space and time, though, that really is deserving our attention right now. And this one reported by the San Francisco Gate, Ariana Beinman, who notes that a black hole that has recently been discovered has a very peculiar aspect that has a UC Berkeley team led by graduate student Casey Lamb, as well as astronomy associate professor Jessica Liu, really scratching their heads. Why? Because it's been described as a free-floating black hole. What's that? Well, according to the Gate here, they say they estimate this black hole is an invisible object, which they have dubbed OB110462, that is between 1.6 and 4.4 times the mass of the Sun and about 2,280 to 6,260 light-years away. They say it could also be what's known as a neutron star, a city-sized star which is born when massive stars collapse and die, but they say regardless of whether it's a black hole, indeed, as they suspect, or a neutron star, they say that the mysterious object is, well, really strange. They are calling it a stellar ghost because of the fact that it was discovered just floating through space without any kind of an accompanying star. So that is really weird. Usually, there are certain criteria associated with black holes. And that, I think, is part of the reason why they aren't really sure if this is indeed a black hole or a neutron star. Whatever this thing is, we might call it, you know, for lack of any better term, a gravity anomaly that is indeed effectively floating through space out there. I'll further quote from the article here. They note, this is the first free-floating black hole or neutron star discovered with gravitational microlensing, according to Liu, who's been hunting for free-floating black holes since way back in 2008, and has been observing OB110462 since 2020. As Liu says, with microlensing, we're able to probe these lonely, compact objects and weigh them. I think we've opened a new window onto these dark objects, which can't really be seen in any other way. Though black holes are typically invisible, researchers can use gravitational microlensing to see how they warp and distort light from distant stars with their powerful gravitational field. I'll further add, you guys remember the photos that appeared online in recent years of the first black hole. Well, this wasn't the first black hole that was ever discovered, and it wasn't really a photo. What this was it was information about a black hole that was gathered, and then there was a image that was constructed based on that data. So it's sort of a image representation of the black hole that was composed using data, not an actual photograph of a black hole. You can't see them, right? But again, you talk about the mysteries of space and time. Look at all the stuff that's going on further out there in space. All the questions that we have. Many scientists, rather paradoxically, get really hung up on the mysteries of space. Astronomers are like, you know, let's look for life out there. Let's try to resolve these mysteries out there. One would really think it's about time for astronomers here on Earth to start applying those same sorts of ideas, those same sorts of scientific standards, toward phenomena that are occurring closer to home. And that is indeed exactly what NASA has announced in recent days, and we'll be diving into that big NASA announcement here in short order. But first, before we go to the break, I do want to take a moment to remind you, of course, why I enjoy Athletic Greens so much, and hence why you hear me talk about it on the podcasts so often. Yes, I take Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens is a multivitamin supplement, which is all natural. And let me tell you, it's going to help you out. I speak from experience, folks. It helps me. I'm a very active person, crazily so. You know, if I've got a cold, I may pare back a little on my exercise routine, but I'm still going to exercise. When I'm traveling, I'm going to get out and walk. I'm going to jog. I'm going to always remain active. And if you want to be able to maintain that kind of physical activity, it takes energy. And if you really want to be able to maintain those peak energy levels that facilitate exercise and thereby overall well-being, you've got to get the nutrients your body needs. You've got to have the things that will nourish your body and help it recover. For me, that's been Athletic Greens, which allows your body, when you take it, to absorb 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens. And although you're getting a lot out of it, it's really easy to do. You just tear open a packet, pour it into a glass of water, drink that on an empty stomach to start your day every day, and you're all good to go. So again, I really love taking Athletic Greens. It helps me have more energy in the daytime. I sleep a little better at night. And also, as far as taking multivitamin supplements, there are a lot of those available on the market. But I want you to ask yourself, how many of them are carbon neutral companies? How many of them also donate to charities like No Kid Hungry? These are all perks that come with taking Athletic Greens. Plus, let me remind you, it's lifestyle friendly. Whether you are keto, paleo, vegan, a super protein guy, a dairy or gluten-free dieter, Athletic Greens is going to work for you. And plus, it costs you less than $3 a day. You're investing in your health, and it's actually even cheaper than your cold brew habit. Now listen, guys, I've told you before, I'll tell you again, right now it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just that one scoop in a cup of water every day, and that's it, without any need for millions of different pills and supplements, just to look out for your health. And to make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you that free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs, the likes of which I carry with me everywhere, with your first purchase. All you got to do is visit athleticgreens.com/MICAH. That's athleticgreens.com/Micah, my name, to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. And with that, it is now time for us to get into our discussion about what NASA has said about UAP. Why they're getting involved? It almost seemed inevitable, right? The U.S. Space Agency would finally weigh in on this subject. That appears to be what will be happening this fall. And indeed, during a recent press conference, they had a lot to say about it. I'll give you a full report when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. So NASA has just announced that it plans to set up an independent study on unidentified aerial phenomena. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Big news in recent days. I was actually a part of this media teleconference that they held the other day. And there were a lot of questions from reporters about, well, the who's, the what's, the where's, the why's, the when's, the how's. What's going to happen as NASA gets involved in the UAP debate? According to a press release over there at NASA.gov, from which here I will quote, and then we'll go to some audio sound bites, NASA is commissioning a study team to start early in the fall to examine unidentified aerial phenomena, or UAPs. That is, and I think this is important, by the way, they give us their definition of UAP. They say observations of events in the sky that cannot be identified as aircraft or known natural phenomena, and from a scientific perspective. That's a pretty good definition. a little different maybe from certain other definitions of UAP we've seen thrown around in recent years. As the press statement continues, they note the study will focus on identifying available data, how best to collect future data, and how NASA can use that data to move the scientific understanding of UAPs forward. The limited number of observations, they note, of UAPs currently makes it difficult to draw scientific conclusions about the nature of such events. Unidentified phenomena in the atmosphere are of interest for both national security and air safety, this of course mirroring somewhat what appeared in the ODNI report last June. But they also note that establishing which events are natural provides a key first step to identifying or mitigating such phenomena, which aligns with one of NASA's goals to ensure the safety of aircraft. Now, let me briefly comment on that. Keep in mind, as I've reported over at The Debrief in the past, and as I've covered in books I've written like The Ghost Rockets over the years, NASA actually maintains a database on behalf of the FAA, which is called the Aviation Safety Reporting System. And so if a lot of people are looking at this and thinking, you know, what's up with NASA's goals to ensure the safety of aircraft? Well, indeed, they have quite a history of doing that, but they also include a link in that statement in the press release to their airspace operations and safety page, which is also briefly worth mentioning here. The AOSP, as it's known, works with the Federal Aviation Administration, industry, and academic partners to conceive and develop next-generation air transportation system technologies to further improve the safety of current and future aircraft. They note, as radar-based air traffic control transitions to a next-gen satellite-based system to enhance safety, capacity, and efficiency on runways and in flight, AOSP-developed next-gen methods and means will provide advanced automated support to air navigation service providers and aircraft operators to reduce air travel times and delays, and to ensure greater safety in all weather conditions. Some of the projects that they have listed here include airspace technology demonstrations, air traffic management exploration, system-wide safety, and unmanned aerial system traffic management. So, in light of all these things, with NASA's Airspace Operations and Safety Program, and of course their collection of data on behalf of the FAA with their Aviation Safety Reporting System, yeah, it should come as no surprise whatsoever that NASA includes among its goals ensuring the safety of aircraft. However, now coming back to the NASA press statement about UAP, they also say right now there's no evidence UAPs are extraterrestrial in origin. Now, the agency's independent study team, according to the release, will be led by astrophysicist David Spergel, who I've been looking into a bit in recent days. Interesting guy, and more on that in a moment. But he's currently president of the Simmons Foundation in New York City and previously the chair of the astrophysics department at Princeton University at Princeton in New Jersey. We also have Daniel Evans, the Assistant Deputy Associate Administrator of Research at NASA's Science Mission Directorate, who's going to serve as the NASA official responsible for orchestrating the study. The press release quotes Spergel, and it's probably better that I read this quote from him, because during the actual press conference the other day, it was very difficult to hear him over the telephone for some reason. You'd think that they'd have a better kind of audio system for these kinds of press conferences they're holding with the media. It sounded so bad at times, I'm sure some probably were left wondering if it might not have been intentional, right? The less they can hear, the less they'll know. The less they know, the better we all are. I'm kidding. But they quote Spergel here saying, "Given the paucity of observations, our first task is simply to gather the most robust set of data we can. We will be identifying what data from civilians, government, nonprofits, companies, etc. exists, what else we should try to collect, and how best to analyze it." Now, a lot of people kind of responded to this press conference going, well, that was a whole bunch of nothing, wasn't it? Essentially, they said the same thing in response to the ODNI report last June, and I'm always mystified when people listen to these conferences and say, there was no reference of the crash wreckage retrievals, no mention of alien bodies. Where are the triangle photos we were promised? And I'm thinking to myself, guys, this is a group of NASA scientists proposing a scientific study of UAP. If you're hoping for crash wreckage retrievals, triangle photos, alien bodies, and other things which in large part have constituted the myth that's been built around UFOs over the decades, that ain't gonna be where you're gonna receive it. Not during a press conference with NASA scientists who are saying, yeah, we want to do a really sober, sane analysis of all the data we can collect on UAP and see what it means. And, notably, then we want to make that freely available to the public. And that's probably the most important thing here. Yes, it's good that we've got scientists wanting to look at this. Yes, it's good that the military is doing that too, but the biggest difference is the stuff AIMSOG's going to be collecting up there for the DOD. Do you expect to see all that? Yeah, there are going to be reports. Yeah, a lot of information will be made available in special briefings to members of Congress, but they, of course, have to have a clearance for that. As far as what trickles down to the general public, there's going to be very little, based on the kinds of standards set by the ODNI report from last June. But with this NASA study, they say the entire thing you can expect to see. We're going to hold a press conference once it's actually complete, and the entire study will be made available for everybody to see. We want complete transparency on this, so they say. And to me, that's actually very hopeful. Returning again to the press release here, they note the study is expected to take about 9 months to complete. It will secure the Council of Experts in the scientific, aeronautics, and data analytics communities to focus on how best to collect new data and improve observations of UAPs. Evans, at one point during the press conference, stated, and again, this is in furtherance of the transparency I was talking about, consistent with NASA's principles of openness, transparency, and scientific integrity, Evans said this report will be shared publicly. All of NASA's data is available to the public. We take that obligation seriously, and we will make it easily accessible for anyone to see or study. Although unrelated to this new study, they note, NASA has an active astrobiology program that focuses on the origins, evolution, and distribution of life beyond Earth. I always find it kind of strange that they throw things like that in with these press statements. I mean, I understand why they do it, but again, if it is actually unrelated to the UAP study, and they don't want to necessarily cause people to make potentially tenuous connections between UAP and alien life, why do they bring up astrobiology and the fact that they're actively involved in goals that include finding signs of life beyond Earth? I mean, to me, it's kind of funny. I guess whoever wrote this press release is just thinking, well, that's probably worth mentioning. There's enough commonality in these two topics that we could mention one here in a press release about the other. But again, all that really does to me is it seems to sort of subconsciously insinuate that, yeah, UAPs are being studied, and NASA's also looking for aliens. Hint, hint. Right? Furthermore, the press statement also adds, the agency's search for life also includes using missions such as the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite and Hubble Space Telescope to search for habitable exoplanets, while the James Webb Space Telescope will try to spot biosignatures and atmospheres around other planets, spotting oxygen and carbon dioxide in other atmospheres, for example. It could suggest that an exoplanet supports plants and animals like ours does. Now here again, I have to ask, why even mention that if you don't want people to make associations between alien life and UAP? Here's a question. This is purely speculation on my part, but do they make passing references to their existing studies that involve the search for alien life within a press release about their forthcoming UAP study so as to intentionally plant those kinds of seeds of thought in the minds of readers? Maybe not a crazy question. Also might not have been entirely intended on part of whoever the author was, but now I want to go to the audio here and feature a few quick snippets from the press conference the other day. Leading off here, we have Thomas Zurbuchen talking about this UAP study, what it means and why NASA is getting involved.
NASA's mission, of course, as I just said, is to explore the unknown in air and space. And we have access, frankly, as part of that, to a broad range of observations of Earth and space. And frankly, that's the lifeblood of our scientific inquiry. We have the tools and teams who can help us improve our understanding of the unknown. And we are prepared to use these powerful tools of scientific discovery in this case as much as anything else, using exactly the same kind of approach that we always use. Unidentified phenomena in the atmosphere of interest for many reasons, frankly, I think there's new science to be discovered. There's been many times where something that looked almost magical turned out to be a new scientific effect. But there's also national security and air safety issues that have been discussed elsewhere that, of course, relate to these observations. And establishing, with events that are, whether they're natural or whether they are, need to be explained otherwise, is very much aligned with NASA's goals that ensure, of course, that we discover the unknown, but also ensures the safety of aircraft that, of course, are in that airspace.
So there you can hear Zurbuchen kind of touching on all the key points here and also emphasizing that safety of aircraft issue. But now in this next audio soundbite, Zurbuchen is talking about who's actually going to lead this study and what their roles and their focuses will be.
This independent study will be led by astrophysicist David Sporgel, who's the president of the Simons Foundation in New York City and has previously been the chair of astrophysics in the Department of Princeton and the University of Princeton, New Jersey. Dan Evans, the Assistant Deputy Associate Administrator for Research, is the wheels on the bus, kind of really making sure that we're interfacing with this. Some people may ask why Dan. First of all, Dan, with his tremendous experience, both as a researcher but also as an enabler for research, his work that he did in the White House previously, I think has tremendous insight into kind of the cross interagency aspect that relates to some of these discussions. And David Spergel, I think, to all of us in astrophysics, really understand that he's one of the most trusted voices in so many questions. Also a person who understands really the power of science and is willing and able to use that power of science kind of in areas where I would say kind of fall under that what we would refer to as high risk, high impact kind of research, kind of areas that many of the scientists may be a little bit more timid to walk into.
A quick one I'll throw in here is from Dan Evans, who was talking about why, in his view, during the press conference the other day, NASA is uniquely fitted for a study like this. Don't take my word for it. Here's what he had to say.
Over the decades, NASA has answered the call to tackle some of the most perplexing mysteries we know of, and this is no different. I do want to underscore that NASA is uniquely positioned to address UAPs, because who other than us can use the power of data and of science look at what's happening in our skies. Quite frankly, this is why we do what we do. Now, for this study specifically, we plan on bringing together some of the country's leading scientists, aeronautics experts, and data practitioners. We expect the study to kick off in the early fall. It should take about 9 months to complete. And I want to make this point emphatically, that very much consistent with our principles of openness, transparency, and scientific integrity, the full report will be made available to the public, and we expect to hold a public meeting to discuss the study's findings.
So there again, Mr. Evans pointing out the fact that, yeah, we're going to hold a public meeting. This entire study is going to be available to the public when we're done with it. You can expect transparency, folks. At least so they say. And of course, transparency will be helpful if NASA actually finds anything. Wouldn't it be fascinating, though, if with all this effort currently underway by the AIMSOG at the DOD, you know, with Avi Loeb's Galileo Project and its independent search for answers to the UAP issue, with a lot of civilian researchers like yours truly trying to look into this, wouldn't it be fascinating if after all this time NASA finally gets into the game and they start looking through their data, you know, they liaison with different civilian groups, and after they collect as much data as they can and then they complete their review, they're like, wow, you know, guys, there really is something here. Hey, here's the best data we have actually found. Some of these things actually seem to indicate aircraft of some kind. They don't match any known existing aircraft. We don't know whose they are, but there's definitely somebody operating in our airspace. Wow, we didn't expect to see that. That would be interesting indeed. But now, you'll note I haven't featured any audio soundbites from David Spergel yet, who's actually going to lead this study. I do want to feature one audio soundbite from him now, and this from a separate video online, where he was doing a brief interview and he was being asked about the kinds of things that got him into astronomy in the first place and what essentially launched his career. I think in light of the fact that he'll be leading this NASA study on UAP, you may find the following audio soundbite of Dr. Spergel rather interesting. I know I did.
I'm of the generation that watched Star Trek and wondering whether there were aliens out there was certainly one of the first questions I wondered about.
And what's your opinion of that question today?
I still don't know. You know, I think at this point, we astronomers have done a lot of the work we need to on this. We've shown that planets are common. I think from what we know, we suspect that there are indeed Earth-like planets out there. Now the question is really one of first biology. Given a planet that's like Earth, how often will life arise? And the next one is a question really of political science. Given an advanced life form, how long do they survive before they blow themselves up? Do they expand through the universe? Or is intelligence in some way self-destructive? And we don't know the answer to those questions at all.
Are you an optimist on those questions?
I'm generally an optimist, yeah.
So the gentleman who will be leading the NASA study on UAP is generally an optimist. I guess I feel pretty good about that. I'm glad to know that there is an open-minded astronomer who will be leading a NASA study looking into the UAP mystery, and that he seems to have a hopeful attitude toward what this might represent, what it could all mean, what we might learn from studying it. You know, I also reached out in recent days to a couple of scientists who I admire and trust, and I asked for their opinions about this. The first was Robert Powell, whose background is in chemistry, but he's best known, of course, as one of the executive board members for the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. Finally got to catch up and have a beer with Robert, by the way, at the SCU event in Alabama last weekend. And here is what he had to say about the current NASA study, what has been said about it, and what his expectations are. He notes first that NASA's media presentation displayed an open-minded scientific approach to the UAP issue. He also added that their involvement helps bring mainstream science to bear on a resolution to this enigma. And as they rightly pointed out, this could be due to multiple causes. He also added, with regard to his own organization, the SCU, of which I'm also a member, that the SCU would urge NASA's study team to begin by reaching out to other scientists and scientific organizations that have already begun studying the UAP issue. Examine what is already known. The Scientific Coalition of UAP Studies can provide NASA with information gleaned from projects that have already been initiated in the study of this phenomena. Now, that's so important because NASA says we're going to look at civilian data, government data, we're going to try and collect and find all data that may be relevant, see what we've got on hand, see what we need to find, and do our best to try and analyze that. I'm sincerely hoping that NASA, and folks at NASA, by the way, if you're listening to this, I know sometimes some of you do, feel free to contact me, info@micahanks.com or mica@thedebrief.org, but definitely please head over to scu.org. Take a look at the science papers that have been published by our team. Look at some of the analysis the team has done. Definitely consider looking at the SCU's work because, in my humble opinion, it is probably the best representation of science that's been applied toward the UAP mystery in the modern era. I also reached out to Dr. Chris Impey. Some of you guys may remember Dr. Impey with the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona, Tucson, who was on the program a while back, and this actually in advance of the publication of the ODNI report last year. And I asked Chris a few questions, which included, what are the benefits of having the U.S. Space Agency becoming more involved in the serious scientific study of UAP? And MP essentially says this: NASA has many experts on aircraft and spaceflight and advanced technologies, and so they're well-placed to gather high-quality data and interpret it thoroughly but skeptically. MP also told me that NASA has high public respect as an independent and transparent government agency. In David Spergel, the gentleman we just heard the audio from there, they have picked a senior and highly accomplished astronomer to lead the study. They start their project with open minds. He also goes on to note the existing data on hand, which would include the more than 400 recent reports from the military. Now, whether NASA will have access to that is a good question. I hope they do. He also notes hundreds more going back decades, which this, of course, is a reference to historical data. Very glad that Chris Impey, like me, is suggesting that NASA look at all that. He also says many of those will not involve data of sufficient quality to readily interpret, so they'll have to cast a wide net to get more data, including from the FAA and from networks of telescopes that monitor the sky. But again, MP points out, Spergel does not have security clearance, but they will need to include data that is currently classified, so I'm hoping that somebody will be able to get access to that information and be able to ensure that Spergel will have access to the most relevant data from classified sources. Hopefully, one would think that would be a part of the scope of NASA's study. But then a final quick note here. MP also told me that NASA is going to have to navigate the waves of interest that come from UFO acolytes, conspiracy theorists, and people who are convinced they already know the answer. There will be criticism, he says, some of it reflexive and unconsidered, at a cost of under $100,000. That, by the way, the price tag that they cited during the press conference the other day. MP notes that they can tell people it's a small price to pay to potentially answer one of the biggest mysteries in science. So well said, Dr. Impey. And again, you know, when we're talking about conspiracy theorists and acolytes who already think they know what all this is one of the issues. Everybody seems to have their idea of what this is. They're drones, bro. They're just weather phenomena. UAP exist, but they are natural. They are plasmas. Well, I can assure you, if you really look at all the data that we've collected over the decades with regard to the UAP mystery, it is a much deeper and a far more complex problem, and it's one very deserving of our attention. And in fact, that is the reason why, when we come back here in a moment, we're now going to shift our attention to the question of intention. What is the intention behind these apparent technologies? And I think we'll do that through the lens of one of the best known and most talked about UAP incidents of recent memory right here on the Micah Hanks Program.
Thank you.
A brief interlude, my friends. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Here in short order, UAP intentions. What is the meaning of all this madness that is the modern UAP debate? And of course, we're going to turn our sights on one of the most widely discussed UAP incidents, not only of recent years, but truly of all time, here in mere moments. But first, I do want to, of course, bring your attention over to the fact that if you're listening to this podcast and you aren't already an X subscriber, you're only getting half the story. That's right. Every week we have the additional edition known as the X podcast that goes out to our subscribers and monthly specials, which we call the Enigmas podcasts. All of that for just $7 a month, or you can get 1 month free, become an annual subscriber. That's just $77 a year. All the information on how to do that can be found right there in your podcasting app in the show notes every week, or you could head over to MicahHanks.com/podcast and just look for X memberships in the upper right-hand corner of the page. Plus, that is the best way to support all the effort and work that goes into this subject. You know, I had an email come through the other day from a colleague who says, you know, Micah, you couldn't be making all that much money from the kind of work that you do with your podcasts, with your writing for the Debrief. I mean, is it really worth it? I've got to be honest, if it weren't for the support of people out there like you, my listeners, it would be impossible. Think about this. This is a brilliant business model I operate. You know, we make everything freely available over there at thedebrief.org. You don't have to pay to read any of those articles. None of the fantastic videos or interviews that Chrissy Newton is doing over there for the Rebelliously Curious podcast she does on our YouTube channel is put behind a paywall. Yes, you can subscribe and you can get additional podcasts from yours truly here at the Micah Hanks program. But the main podcast, the complete public podcast every week, is made entirely free. There are a lot of podcasts that you can listen to the first half for free, and then you got to pay to hear the rest of the interview, or you can listen to the first two episodes, and then you got to subscribe and start paying a monthly premium in order to be able to get access to all the episodes. And from the outset, I always knew I wanted to try and take a different approach, which is also a challenging one at times, because when you make everything that you do freely available to the public, you're sort of at the mercy of people who are willing to contribute and support the work that you do. More often than not, yes, it is a labor of love. But again, those of you who have been subscribers for many years, you guys continue to make this show available for everybody, including those who simply can't afford to subscribe or aren't able for other reasons. And so it's very much a family that we have of subscribers, supporters, people who really make this show possible every week. I definitely thank every one of you who are supporters, and if you've been thinking about getting into the mix, getting access to the entire back catalog of shows that include the subscriber-only shows, the Enigma specials, and the main public podcast, you can do all of that right there at MicahHanks.com/podcast. And so with that brief interlude out of the way, when we come back here in a moment, we're going to shift our attention to the question over UAP intention. Who are they? What are they? Are they? They? But if they are, what is their intention, and what can we learn from the study of UAP behavior? We're going to look at that again, and one of the most widely talked about incidents of modern times right here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program. During the autumn of 2004, off the southern coast of California, the United States Navy's Carrier Strike Group 11 was completing its successful Fleet Replacement Squadron Carrier qualification. Following a six-month pier-side planned incremental availability, the U.S. Nimitz had returned to full operational status. On September 24, 2004, the supercarrier, one of the largest in the U.S. Navy's arsenal, headed to NAS North Island, its air department assisting in more than 600 arrested landings during this period, while the flight deck crew carried out more than 80 traps to support additional landing signal officer proficiency training. Pilot qualifications and requalifications also ensued, while other tests were conducted by personnel elsewhere aboard the carrier group. By late October, The strike group was involved in virtual exercises, and in the early days of November, the Nimitz was joined for the first time in its training exercises by Carrier Air Wing 11, as well as the Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser Princeton and the Desron 23 destroyers Higgins and Chaffee in advance of the forthcoming composite training unit exercise, a rehearsal undertaken by U.S. Navy carrier strike groups which occurs prior to their department for deployment. In short, the Nimitz strike group was underway, and nothing seemed out of the ordinary as its crew proceeded with routine training exercises off the California coast in advance of its scheduled deployment to the Western Pacific the following year. However, the sense of normalcy members of the strike group might have felt would soon change once operators aboard the Princeton first began to notice something odd on their advanced phased array radar systems. The anomalies began as intermittent radar tracks detected by the vessel's AN-SPY-1B passive scanning phased array radar. The detections were so unusual that radar operator Kevin Day initially thought the new system might just be malfunctioning. On November 10th, Day noticed what appeared to be between 5 and 10 radar traces traveling due south in some kind of loose formation. The objects were at an altitude of approximately 28,000 feet, passing near Catalina Island. Rather than displaying strange or incredible acceleration, what seemed the strangest to Kevin Day had been the way the objects moved so slowly at their current altitude.
I was up on watch. I was standing in my anti-air warfare coordinator watch position, and up towards Catalina Island, a couple hundred miles northwest or so, I noticed these odd tracks off the coast of Catalina. The reason why I say they were odd is because they were at, there was like five of them, if I remember right, from my logbook. And they were at 28,000 feet going 100 knots, which is just a little bit over 100 miles an hour. And they were tracking south. And I was thinking to myself, what in the hell can fly like that? A hot air balloon? No one in our strike group seemed to know what the ID was. And I still don't to this day. They weren't broadcasting any type of electronic signatures that we could help us ID with. They were not on the Comair routes. They weren't flying normal flight parameters. Normally, things that high going that slow are probably going to fall out of the sky unless they're lighter than air.
Checking with radar operators on nearby vessels, Day was able to confirm that the objects were indeed being tracked by other operators within the strike group. Day's shipmate, Gary Voorhees, also described how radar operators tracked the object for several days.
We had tracked the unknowns for quite a while, and honestly, it wasn't until we had taken the system down, recalibrated it, and then brought it back online. Then I'm talking about SPY-1 Bravo radar. You know, once we brought it back up and we realized that they were solid, real tracks, we tracked them for, quite a while until one day when I got the word that they're doing an intercept.
On November 14th, when one of the objects was detected on radar in advance of training operations scheduled for that morning, Kevin Day contacted aircraft that were operating nearby and requested that they investigate. The first responding pilot was Colonel Douglas Kurth, a Marine Corps F-A-18 Hornet pilot, who began to approach the area where the anomalous radar signature had been detected. Shortly afterward, two U.S. Navy F-A-18 EF Super Hornets, one of which was piloted by Commander David Fravor, also approached the area where the object was seen. Fravor and his weapons systems officer, along with accompanying pilot Alex Dietrich and her WSO, Lieutenant Jim Slate, initially observed a disturbance on the ocean surface, above which there appeared to be a white object.
As we're looking at this, her backseater says, "Hey, Skipper, do you?" And about that got out, I said, "Dude, do you see that thing down there?" And we saw this little white, tic-tac-looking object, and it's just kind of moving above the whitewater area.
Suddenly, as Fravor began to move down in the direction of the unusual object, he watched as it appeared to become aware of his presence and took action.
Actually, when it turned and started coming up, it was kind of like, okay. Because we have nothing that goes that fast and just starts climbing at will.
Pilot Alex Dietrich, who had been observing from above, later described the object's movements as being something she and her fellow pilots simply couldn't anticipate.
We couldn't anticipate its next move. So normally when you're looking at another aircraft, we do a lot of BFM or aerial combat maneuvering where we are looking at turn circles or turn radius and anticipating the next move of our adversary, or if we're skirmishing with each other, and in this particular case, it just broke the mold and kind of blew our minds in terms of the way it was maneuvering.
Gary Voorhees, who had been on board the Princeton at the time of the intercept attempt, recalled how he and others felt when they observed footage of the object for the first time.
Once we actually seen them as a group, it was hard to for anybody to say this wasn't like a something that was happening now. You know, before we actually physically saw them and did the intercept, they were just, random dots in the sky, random lights in the sky on the horizon, and just these little dots on a radar screen. You know, and then all of a sudden we're all in there, and I mean, everybody got pretty quiet at first when it first started. But like where he was in combat, I was actually in another secret space watching it on a computer screen. So, and everybody in that room, we weren't even breathing. We were watching it, and not a soul was even breathing while we were watching it, because it was just that miraculous.
Voorhees also conveyed to me during a 2020 telephone conversation about the incident how he remembered the astonishing capabilities of the object as it moved.
It was moving in conjunction with the pilot. It would move out of the frame, but then the pilot would adjust and it would come back into frame, and then it would just move sharp to the right, sharp to the left, up, down, any particular direction it wanted to go. It didn't seem like, it had no rudders, it had no props, no jet plume, you couldn't tell which side was the front, which side was the back, except that you just assume that which way is going forward is front. But, you can't even really assume that, because it would just move sideways. It would move up, left, down, forward, any way it wanted to go, at any speed it wanted to go.
Following the intercept attempt, Commander Fravor, Dietrich, and their weapons systems officers were returning to the Nimitz again when radar operators aboard the Princeton alerted them that they had located the object again, this time at a surprising location.
We start heading back, and the controller on the Princeton comes up and he says, "Sir, you're not going to believe this, but that thing is back at your cap point. That was our original point where we were going to hold 40 miles south of the ship." So this thing has went from wherever we were at to, about 60 miles in, maybe 30, 40 seconds, it's already over there. And they didn't track it. It just appeared. It shows back up on their radar and they go, "It's here." So we're like, okay. So we fly back. We don't see it. We don't see it on our radar. We don't see it on any of our sensors. We do like two runs and we come back to the ship and land.
Upon his return to the Nimitz, Fravor met the weapons systems officer of another outgoing flight, Lieutenant Chad Underwood, and after alerting him to the object's presence in the vicinity, advised that Underwood attempt to film it. Once in flight, Underwood and his pilot were contacted by the Princeton and alerted about an anomalous track on their radar, which Underwood was vectored toward. Soon, the target was located, and Underwood had trained his aircraft's AppFlyer targeting pod onto the unusual object, which immediately began to engage in unusual, evasive maneuvers.
The track started doing all sorts of just little things that are not normal. The heading was erratic. It should be able to tell me your airspeed and also your Mach number. So it should say like 0.8 Mach, for example. So, 80% the speed of sound. It should say that. It was jumping all over the place. It was like 0.8, 0.4, 0.2, 0.1, 0.9. And it's just like my radar can't hack it. And in all instances, it should be able to hack that. And then I was also receiving what they're called strobe lines. And they just basically look like lines on your radar that are indications that you're being jammed. So that tic-tac jamming us would be considered an act of war.
Underwood, who had famously observed the object while tracking it with the AppFlyer pod, is recognized today as the man who filmed the so-called tic-tac, the unofficial nickname that he gave to the object he and other pilots encountered that day in November of 2004. Hearing Underwood, Dietrich, and Fravor discuss the incident causes the reality of what was occurring to set in. Here we had an object, clearly displaying advanced technological capabilities, and doing so under circumstances that, as Underwood pointed out, essentially constitute an act of war. Indeed, we are left with more questions than answers. With regard to the intercept attempt, it is odd that Navy aircraft would be given orders to engage an unknown object, while the aviators in question had no weapons capabilities. After all, they weren't armed at the time. There are also no technologies that are known to exist today, whether in the possession of the U.S. or any other world power, which can facilitate the flight capabilities displayed by this UAP. The 2004 incident also is unusual for its unprecedented collection of eyewitnesses specializing in a variety of technical areas, ranging from combat flight to radar and weapons systems operation, which indeed helps lend credence and a degree of authority to the observations of those to the Nimitz events. Also, the U.S. Nimitz incident is of significance in terms of UAP studies due to the visual record and instrumental data obtained in relation to the object. This is not only beneficial in terms of the furtherance of scientific knowledge related to UAP more broadly, but it has helped garner attention from members of the scientific community, which may otherwise have avoided such topics. But beyond the scientific merit, the cultural significance of the Nimitz incident is also of importance, as it raises awareness of issues related to UAP. These might range from national security implications to the more speculative considerations like the existence of advanced technologies operating on Earth that are well beyond the scope of any civilian, scientific, or even military organizations. Further, the possible existence of other forms of intelligence apart from humans must be considered in relation to this. But perhaps most curious of all was the UAP's apparent knowledge of encrypted communication systems related to combat air patrol information, which in the case of the 2004 Nimitz incident apparently allowed it to determine the cap point for Strike Fighter Squadron 41. This apparent knowledge of the cap point, requiring obvious decryption capabilities, may be as impressive as the flight capabilities the UAP appeared to have possessed. But what does this mean? And what can it tell us about the UAP in question? Obviously, if the UAP hadn't wanted Strike Fighter Squadron 41 personnel to know that it was able to read its encrypted communication, it very simply could have left the scene altogether and avoided approaching the cap point or engaging in any other kind of activity that would clearly convey one thing. We, whoever they are, can hear you. We can decrypt your encrypted communications channels. We know what you're doing. We know where you're going. And we can get there quicker than you can. Of course, it's entirely speculative to assume that these are the intentions being conveyed by the UAP during the 2004 Nimitz incident, but one thing that cannot be ignored is the fact that the object, in addition to displaying advanced aerospace capabilities, was obviously aware of the pilots nearby, and also seemed to possess more than just an ability to outmaneuver those aircraft. But here again, the obvious question resurfaces. If the UAP, and possibly any intelligence controlling it, had been monitoring encrypted communication systems in use by Strike Fighter Squadron 41, then why seemingly make that obvious to the military personnel present by going and hovering at their designated cap point? We may never know the answers to these questions, but the implications could potentially be profound, and they may offer a clue in terms of the intention of some of the UAP and the intelligences behind them, which we'll explore more when we return here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program. UAP intention. What is it that they intend to convey to us, especially in incidents like that of the 2004 Nimitz and the UAP, which seemingly returned to a designated cap point, which it could only have known about if it were monitoring encrypted communications channels? There are a lot of questions, and obviously there are some speculations that must be applied in a discussion like this. We simply don't know what the intent of the UAP might have been in this case or in any other case. But I do find it interesting that closer inspection of some of the modern UAP incidents does perhaps give us some clues and also has some parallels to past cases that are worthy of note and which, in fact, we've focused on this program. Recently, while attending the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies Anomalous Aerospace Phenomena conference down there in Huntsville, Alabama, Chrissy Newton and I caught up with Travis Taylor. And Travis has recently undertaken an analysis of the gimbal video, and he pointed out something very interesting to Chrissy and I that he noticed about the footage, which seems to be that the identification friend or foe unit on board the aircraft at that time, the information for which appears also in the display in the famous gimbal footage that we can see, appears to be responding to an IFF query in the affirmative, i.e., that it's friendly. And Travis thought this was pretty interesting. And when I heard Dr. Taylor saying this, of course, it struck me as interesting on account of the fact that, as we've covered in the past on this program, there are several cases in the Blue Book files where UFOs appeared to have responded to IFF queries in the affirmative. And in fact, this had actually been part of what was being discussed down there at the SCU event, because on Saturday night, Peter Reilly and Robert Powell and others took to the stage and began to discuss some of the current studies that SCU has recently been undertaking, and one of them which has been of interest to me since I first learned about it from Larry Hancock, who was on the program a while back, involves what they appropriately call the intention study. Are there displayed behaviors by UAP from over the years that we can study so as to help us formulate a better idea about the intent of these objects and or the occupants or intelligence that's controlling them? Now, if we back up, a while back I did a episode on this program that looked at the famous Lubbock Lights case and a UFO sighting that was tangent to all that occurred back in 1951. It involved a strange aircraft that was detected flying north at about 900 miles an hour across Washington, and a U.S. Air Force ground radar facility initiated a identification friend or foe query to this UFO. And to their surprise, they actually got an affirmative response. Friendly. It's one of ours. And right now I'd like to feature a brief audio soundbite from that program where I essentially provide my concluding analysis about what this might have meant back in 1951, and also why it's important in the context of some of the classified technologies that were in use by the U.S. Air Force at that time. And as you're about to hear in this following audio soundbite, I'm referring to a collection of Blue Book unknowns that has been compiled over the last several years by researcher Brad Sparks. Indeed, what Sparks has noticed about some of these Blue Book cases, I certainly found interesting and potentially points to one of two very striking possibilities about the nature of some of these unknown UFO incidents from the Blue Book era. In the entry that he had for the incident dated August 26, 1951, involving Larson Air Force Base in Washington, we have, if you recall, the inclusion of the following details. Object transmitted IFF Mode 1 signal in response to radar transponder interrogations from Larson Air Force Base's TPX-22 interrogation set, possibly using KY-95 or KY-97 encrypted signal generator, which appeared to be emitted twice by an APX-6 transponder or something simulating it on the UFO. Now, why is that of significance? And in fact, here's another question you may be asking yourself. What exactly is an APX-6 transponder? Well, I want to refer to a fact page online about this, and I'll have this linked in the show notes if you'd like to geek out on the tech details with me. But I'll briefly quote from this page, which gives us some details about the APX-6 IFF unit. It says the original APX-6 was introduced around 1950, supporting only single pulses as a reply for a Mode 1, 2, or 3 challenge. In 1952, a modification to the original RT-82 APX-6 was available, which added a plug on the front panel mid-left. This plug connected to a coder unit, KY-95 APX-6, which replied with 5 or 6 bits on each challenge. I want to quote further from a little later in this entry. The author here notes that Dave Trojan adds this information about the APX-6 in U.S. service. Quote, the unit was classified at the time, at least during the early 1950s, and required special handling. Early frequencies used in these sets were also classified, and the radio operator or pilot had to remove the entire set and carry it with him if no military guard facilities were available. Codes had to be set before flight and were not changeable during flight. One of the most interesting things about the APX-6 transponder unit is that they contained explosives for destruction of the tuning heads. In other words, the Cavatrons, if the unit was about to fall into enemy hands. How about that? But I think the most important information right here has to do with A, the fact that the APX-6 was introduced around 1950. There had been a modification to the original available by around 1952. And of course, the fact that the unit had been classified in the early 1950s when it would have been in use. Well, the UFO incident we are referring to here from August 26, 1951, occurred the year after the APX-6 was introduced and the year before the modification was produced. It almost no doubt would have been classified at the time, and hence probably why this information about the IFF response via a transponder on board a UFO would not have been included at the time of Ruppelt writing his book. He probably knew about that. He even references in the chapter the fact that there was some information that had not been made available to the public. In hindsight, though, many years later when the Blue Book files were released publicly, of course this information would have become known. This wouldn't have been a sensitive state secret at that time, as it had been in 1951, when a UFO being tracked flying 900 miles an hour over Washington appeared to respond to an IFF query using what appeared to be an APX-6 transponder, or, as Brad Sparks notes, or something simulating it on the UFO. And of course, bear in mind, there are plenty of other incidents that I've found, thanks to Brad Sparks and his research, that involve IFF signal responses from the Blue Book era. We don't have time to get into all of those. We're taking a deep dive on one which, it just so happens, was one of those quote-unquote good UFO reports that had actually been tangent to the very famous Lubbock Lights incident from 1951. For all we know, the objects that were seen by those scientists in Lubbock, Texas, okay, maybe there was a natural explanation for that. It's a little harder to say the same of the photographs taken by the young man, who also claimed to have seen something in the same general shape flying over the area around that time. That's even harder to say for the security officer from Sandia Labs and his wife, who saw a silent aircraft of swept-wing design with blue lights on it flying silently over their home. What in the heck was that? And if Ruppelt's initial estimate had been correct, just hours later, over Washington, something is seen flying around 900 miles an hour, and this aircraft, whatever it was equipped with what at the time had been a classified APX-6 IFF unit. If it's not already obvious why that's so significant, I'll spell it out for you. This was state-of-the-art IFF transponder technology at the time, and it was classified and in use by the military. So we have to determine one of two things from all this. Whatever the object was flying over Washington that emitted that response to the IFF query was either a secret U.S. technology equipped with a then-classified APX-6 IFF unit, and thereby also equipped with the necessary encrypted code to be able to accurately respond to the queries and indicate that it was friend, not foe, or, as Brad Sparks alluded to, it was some other kind of technology aboard the UFO which appeared to be simulating that. Now, let that sink in for just a moment. In the audio clip that you just heard from that past episode where I broke all this down, Brad Sparks and others have speculated that one of two things must be happening here. Either that aircraft was equipped with classified technology at that time, and it responded as a friendly when it was pinged using the IFF system, or whatever this craft was able to decrypt that information and emulate that technology. A rather interesting possibility. I mentioned Larry Hancock, who's been on the program in the past. He's one of our SCU members. He wasn't at the event, but he's been very involved in this so-called intention study that SCU has been carrying out. And now I want to feature a bit of discussion from Larry talking about the famous RB-47 incident where a similar circumstance also occurred. A UFO was seen. It appeared very clearly to be anomalous. And when the pilots initiated an IFF query, the UAP responded, "Hey, I'm friendly," which, like the Cap Point with the 2004 Nimitz incident and like the 1951 Lubbock Lights incident, would have required the capability of decrypting our encrypted communications channels. Here's what Larry had to say.
One of the things I talk about in the book is in 1957, and I think this is fascinating. You have to wonder, if you're a science fiction fan, you've always read these books that described contact.
Yeah.
And contact would be, well, we send a signal to them, and then they reply with the same signal. And we go, oh, wow, okay. There's something, you know, intelligence there. We can work this out. We'll respond again, and we'll have a back and forth, and we'll communicate. Well, in 1957, over a period of a little more than a week, this is just after we launched First Earth Satellite, right?
Mm-hmm.
First Earth Satellite was launched. SAC, Strategic Air Command, electronic warfare aircraft, RB-47, had a unique incident where it appeared to be receiving a transmission from an Air Defense Command radar. The frequencies were right. The strange thing about this was it was coming from a UFO that was airborne, and that would be really strange, but that was not the first occurrence. Before then, there had been several occurrences where SAC aircraft that were flying long-range patrols over Alaska and Canada had reported that they were getting jamming that was clearly jamming on certain frequencies and coming from UFOs, and clearly it wasn't artificial. It wasn't, it was artificial. It was not, a natural phenomena. And when you read the reports at the time, they thought it was the Soviets playing games with them. Now we know that would not have been possible. But so this had been going on for the time of SAC aircraft reporting, radar jamming, radar transmissions that seemed to be artificial. In this instance, they seemed to match an American Air Defense radar set, which would be really spooky because there's not one of those up at the aircraft altitude. Well, that same week, there were three different incidents at Air Defense Command radar stations where the Air Defense Command radar tracked a highly anomalous, ultra-high speed, multiple Mach rate coming to a stop, et cetera, classic, UFO. But when they interrogated the devices with IFF, identification friend or foe, the devices returned an IFF signal. It's like, wait a minute, this can't be one of ours, but it is one of ours. And it's actually using a code. It's using a code we know. And, of course, there was no response other than, wow, this is troubling. So there are bursts like that where sometimes you sit back and go, wait a minute, did this ever go further? Was somebody trying to communicate in the classic fashion, and because we never respond, they just give it up? I find that sort of thing interesting.
That's really interesting, because even if language were a potential barrier, if technology could be used and they could, in whatever way, if they could scramble or even, decipher our code and return a discernible message which we should recognize using instrumentation. I mean, that's really interesting, and that seems to be what's being described there. Whether it's, again, them being able to jam a radar system or return a code that is recognizable by us as being one of ours. Again, that's really, really interesting. And it reminds me a little of some of the descriptions about the 2004 Nimitz incident, where they're talking about how the object that Commander Fravor and his company apparently witnessed returned to the designated cap point. Now, I've heard some researchers say that may not be what happened. Others say, well, again, if it did, that would also seem to indicate that this craft had the ability to determine that location based on, reading of encrypted communication systems, perhaps. What do you think about that?
Well, and another thing that I've been wrestling with is there might be another message there as well that says, because these incidents occurred over a period of time, that they weren't, it wasn't just a single incident. It could reflect that someone was monitoring the exercises and making note of where the caps were. And it's like, literally, I know how you guys operate. And to demonstrate that to you, I'm going to go out, I'm going to engage with you, and the next time you see me is going to be at the point I know you're going to return to.
Yeah.
Now, that would be a type of communication. It could be innocent communication, just kind of demonstrate to you, I'm watching you and we should talk or whatever. Or it could be, again, troublesome, kind of like, I know so much about what you're doing that I understand your total operational profile. That's troublesome.
That is. But yeah.
The IFF incidents, I sometimes kind of like, okay, this is identification friend or foe. Now, I queried you with an IFF, and you responded me with an identification. What more what did you want me to do? Like, I just responded to your IFF request and told you I'm out here, but I'm clearly, you know, something anomalous. And so I get no response. Well, I guess I'll have to try something else. But in either case, there, I've seen those things. I've seen several of situations where you would almost have to speculate that perhaps there was some effort being made to draw attention. Let's face it, one of the things that's been researched and written about by a number of people were these so-called Hudson River Valley incidents.
I was just about to ask you about those. Yeah.
Yeah. Up from New York. I mean, we're talking about an area that's probably within 50 to 100 miles of the largest population concentration on the continent. Okay. And for a period of literally months and years, hundreds of thousands of people would see these objects that are at very low altitude. They cruise right above freeways. They are big. They're big and obvious. They're structurally very complex. Nobody would confuse them with a normal aircraft. And they have lights all over the place. I mean, they have too many lights. You know, it is clear that they want to be seen, whatever they are, whoever is behind it. And they're showing themselves off to thousands of people, not over downtown New York City, but, you know, if I were getting back to cultural anthropology and I was kind of doing a test, I want to see if I can get your attention. I want to see, you know, what, how do you respond? How do you respond to this? This is kind of like an intelligence test. What do I have to do to get your attention? You would have to step back and say, the Hudson River Valley sightings would be classic. You know, if that does not draw official recognition, official investigation, you know, any kind of an actual response that says something's happening, and it didn't. I mean, it literally didn't. It, other than locally, it drew no response at all. Whoever was doing the demonstration would have to be forced to the conclusion that it's like, you know, we're just not having any luck getting their attention.
Absolutely. And, you know, another interesting thing about all that is you wrote in your book, I'll quote you, as far as is known, those sightings produced no Air Force response of any type, much less a proactive investigation. That, too, is pretty baffling, I'd have to say.
It is. Well, it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier. A current incident, two of them come to mind, and these are both within the last 3-4 years. One current incident was not really a UFO. It was something that had the appearance of an aircraft, unmarked. It was flying at commercial airliner speed, several hundred miles an hour, but nothing really anomalous. And the first crew reports from commercial airliners were out of the Los Angeles area, and there were multiple planes that were seeing it and reporting it to the FAA. And it just blew up the coast all the way to Oregon and Washington. And it was actually apparently reported to NORAD. NORAD did scramble at least one or more interceptors, were unable to intercept it, much less engage and identify it. And it went on. And nobody really knows where it came from, and nobody really knows where it went. Now, why someone did not have to explain that at the highest level of government, I cannot understand. I mean, what is NORAD there? What is the Air Defense Command there? Is that not the most embarrassing thing in the known universe that could have happened? But no one seems to have been called to account for it. And then we have the drone incidents not long after that over Colorado and up into the states that are right adjacent to some of our biggest SAC missile fields, with these drone swarms that were investigated by multiple agencies, except, apparently, NORAD or the Pentagon, other than the individual bases were queried to see if they were doing something, and we have some of their documents that goes, well, it wasn't us. The Air Force going, what? not our, it wasn't our drones. And so the net result is everybody says it wasn't us. How could that not be a national security issue of the highest level? But it wasn't. You know, so I don't know what it really takes to get our attention.
Now, as we're wrapping things up here, just allow what Larry Hancock said there to sink in for a moment. What really does it take to get our attention when it comes to this UFO issue? Let me tell you, if these things at times are capable of seemingly decrypting our encrypted communication systems and thereby communicating with us either through the transmission of a signal with an IFF system or emulating that, seemingly displaying knowledge of its capability of decrypting our communication systems and then going to that cap point during the 2004 Nimitz incident. You know, if the aircraft in the gimbal video is essentially doing the same thing, and pilots like Ryan Graves and others have said we couldn't identify these things, we couldn't even see them with our naked eye, often we could only see them on the cockpit displays or in infrared, and these things might have been doing that if Travis Taylor's analysis is correct. This opens up a lot of questions about what these objects are, how they operate. They may be incredibly clever in the way that they are able to decrypt our encrypted communication systems, and in self-identifying as quote-unquote friendlies, this might actually be a protection mechanism. We're less likely to attack them if they say, hey, we're your friend, in the tradition of the great Klaatu song, right? Calling occupants of interplanetary craft, we are your friends. But I think we should also be very careful about leaping to the conclusion that that's what UAP are trying to convey. There is far more to the idea of the UAP message. And for ex-subscribers, of course, we'll get a little more deep into that. But at least in terms of the technical data that we have on hand and looking at the cases that we have, it seems pretty evident that we can begin to build a narrative around UAP clearly displaying advanced technological capabilities. And indeed, there is some form of intent behind that. But I think we need more scientists, maybe some of our very best scientists and technicians on the case, looking at this, interpreting what may be going on, analyzing that. This indeed could be a key to unlocking parts of the UAP mystery. All right, that'll be the final word for this week's edition of the program. As always, thanks to all you guys who support our efforts. Follow my work over at MicahHanks.com and at thedebrief.org. And as always, I'll talk to you guys next time. And in the meantime, stay strange out there.